Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean, I can feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
This is episode 105 of the podcast. 105, I am Dave, your host. And this was going to be the weekend. This was going to be a big weekend. I had big plans, you know. I was going to go exercise. I was going to go out and, you know, walk to the park. I was going to go maybe see a couple shows, hang out with some friends. I was excited. This is going to be a fun weekend. I had energy. I was looking forward to it. I woke up Saturday morning, and the elevator in my building is broken. It's not working. There is no elevator. I have to take the stairs. So I've been sitting in my apartment all weekend, afraid to leave because I don't want to climb the 7 flights of stairs to get back into my apartment. How is it that this energy, this drive to have a great weekend completely flies out the window at the thought of climbing 7 flights of stairs? Admittedly, not pleasant, but, you know, it's not the end of the world, which is why a talk about paradox seemed to be an appropriate one to bring you this weekend. Today on the podcast, David Perrin is giving a talk about how paradoxes, personal paradoxes, work for us on the path of meditation. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting a week of meditation. Perhaps you can't get away and go to a meditation retreat off in the mountains. So you can do it right here in the city. Meditation in the City. This is the Urban Retreat, 7 days of meditation, the week of August 19th. For more information and to register, click the link on the homepage at ny.shambhala.org. Look it up. It's really a great opportunity to meditate. If you can't do the whole week, you can register by the day. You can register just for the first weekend. It really is a great opportunity to bond over the summer with your fellow meditators. And you got some vacation days. Use them. Use those vacation days. And now, David Perrin, in a talk recorded in late May, a couple months ago, at our weekly Dharma gathering.
What's really wonderful about being able to do this, right, is that now that mindfulness and the practice of mindfulness is becoming more and more ubiquitous, thankfully, in our society, and we can find more and more outlets to learn how to meditate and to practice meditation. It doesn't always necessarily mean that those places where we learn mindfulness, we're also learning about the Dharma. The Dharma is simply a word for truth or things as they are. So I think many of us come here sort of with the dual purpose of, or intention, you could say, of learning about meditation, learning to settle and focus our minds, but then also with questions about, you know, what is my life about? Where am I headed? How is this practice really a tool in my overall journey of self-reflection and contemplation, finding myself, finding meaning in my life? So we're going to talk about that a little bit tonight. And I thought, by way of opening up this particular conversation, that I would read you a poem from Where the Sidewalk Ends. This is Shel Silverstein, for those of you who are familiar. And this is the first poem in the book. I was actually thinking about the topic, and we're going to get into the topic in a second, but thinking about the topic tonight, I was reading this to my 4-year-old daughter the other night. She wanted to read every single one of these poems before she went to bed. We didn't quite get that far. But this is the first one. It's called invitation. If you are a dreamer, come in. If you are a dreamer, a wisher, a liar, a hoper, a prayer, a magic bean buyer. If you're a pretender, come sit by my fire, for we have some flax golden tales to spin. Come in, come in. I'll read it one more time. Invitation. If you are a dreamer, come in. If you are a dreamer, a wisher, a liar, a hoper, a prayer, a magic bean buyer, if you are a pretender, come sit by my fire, for we have some flax golden tales to spin. Come in, come in. So the title of this talk is Personal Paradox as Path. We all have secrets. Anybody out there without a secret? We all have secrets that we don't tell other people. And when we come in here and do this practice and sit on the cushion, we've got pretty good coverage because it's a silent practice and we don't look at anybody. So no one is really going to probe too much as to, well, what are those secrets that that person is bringing to the cushion tonight? But the thing is, we also have secrets that we don't actually share with ourselves. We have places that we don't really want to go with ourselves. It's easy to come into a center like this or come into a situation, particularly around meditation or the spiritual journey, and have a lot of ideas and preconceptions and assumptions about what this notion of spiritual purity is. So what we're actually seeking. We're seeking a sense of resolving these difficult contradictions in our life. So we're looking for clarity, and you could say that it's very natural that clarity is the product or the goal of resolving some of these contradictions, some of these sticky areas in our life that we bring to the cushion, some of these secrets that we're not telling others and we're not actually telling ourselves. So I was thinking about this and I wrote a response to Mr. Silverstein. Come in when you hear your paradox knocking. Come in even if it's shocking. When you want to feel loved, but you don't enjoy being around people. If you're an artist and you haven't made a thing lately. Let's say you're an athlete or you just appreciate being fit, but your body feels tired. Maybe a little bit broken and sore. Some of us out here are the chaste meditators, quietly fantasizing about the girl or boy sitting in row 3. When you know that you speak the truth and you feel like a faker, you want world peace and you get so damn angry sometimes. Come in even if you're a Buddhist who eats meat. Come in even if you're a liar. Sit by my fire. Let's be friends until we don't like each other. And then all over again. So constant paradox. It's happening all the time. We're often trying to resolve it secretly, even if we don't realize that we're doing it. And sometimes we come to the cushion with the intention of following our breath, settling our mind, and in some senses pushing out all of these ambiguities and these contradictions that seem to get in the way. Right? They seem to get in the way of finding peace. There are contradictions of body, there are contradictions of speech, and there are contradictions of mind. Often we work with these three categories of body, speech, and mind when we're talking about what it means to be a meditator, what it means to be on the path of meditation. So just in the piece that I was sharing with you, in terms of body, this idea that we feel like we should be well, we aspire to feeling well, but really actually we feel sick. We feel a little bit nauseous. We might have a headache. Our back hurts. Our legs hurt. And we can't resolve that because the information from the body, the way the body feels, doesn't necessarily adhere to this idea that, well, I'm meditating, I'm eating well. Why some days do I feel like I can't get out of bed or I'm dragging myself out of bed or the only way I can wake up is to have caffeine? This same issue of body has to do with those of us who go to the gym or do something to keep ourselves fit. And you think, well, I've been working out, I'm in pretty good shape, and then you stop for a week and what happens? Mm-hmm. You go back to the gym and it's like you're starting all over again. In terms of speech, there's this interesting notion of expression, right? So what I wrote as a response was this idea that I feel like I'm speaking the truth. Somewhere deep inside me, this what I'm trying to articulate feels true to me. And yet I can't shake the fact that as a teacher, I'm sitting up here and what's coming out of my mouth is bullshit. Right, the paradox of I'm the one up here who was, you know, spinning his mind before this talk thinking, what am I going to say that makes sense and that's true? How am I going to represent the Dharma? How am I going to represent my teachers? And so we're all in situations, in these leadership situations, in our families, in our workplaces, where we prepare, we want to do the right thing, we want to speak this kind of truth to power, and then there's the self-doubt that creeps in. Any artists? Yeah. So do you have that experience of identifying as an artist and then you go through a period of time where you just can't make anything? And then you wonder, am I really an artist? Do I have that identity? And maybe it doesn't occur. Okay. I think that can be the case for some people.
But I'd say like, oh, I'm such a crazy artist. You know, it has something really negative. Oh, if you were like struggling like this, you're a crazy artist.
Right. So if we were a type of way, if we were a type of artist, is that what you're saying? That we then that's a way of kind of. Oh, okay.
That's why I'm crazy. Yeah. I'm an artist.
Yes, okay. So the identity issues.
You're an artist, I mean. Right. Is that where you really want to be?
Right.
Do I aspire to be a painter? No. I'm a painter. Oh. But, you know, I like it.
So that notion of identity. And how sometimes we feel very strongly about our identity, but we can actually begin to use our identity to perpetuate this this notion of resolving contradictions. We can use our identifying with some aspect of our life to to really avoid going into paradox, actually. That sometimes can happen. So whether we feel strongly identified or whether our identification is not so strong, in either case, we are spinning tales. We're spinning stories. Is this idea of paradox resonating with anyone at this point? Does anybody have a personal paradox that they're brave enough to share?
Oh, for me, it's totally, I used to be an athlete, and it's totally the body breaking down, and it's, what? How could this be? And I can't, it's very hard to face it. So, you know, it's, I fight it all the time, and everything hurts all the time, and my arms don't work, my legs don't work. And I'm used to just, you know, and I watch other people walk with ease and reach with ease and, you know, being able to do things, and it's painful.
Yeah, there's what is the quality of what happened.
Yeah. I guess, is that a paradox?
I mean, to me it is, because I also have that same experience of, you know, it used to be a time where I could do certain things that now I have to think twice about doing.
Yeah. Yeah, like I took a walk in the woods and I fell down.
Yeah.
You know, I would have been able to make that jump, you know, 3 years ago.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that.
Sometimes I leave a weekend retreat here. After meditating all day, and then I get aggravated with the people loitering all over the sidewalk in front of the Trader Joe's on the way to the subway. And then I feel like, what was I just doing for 8 hours?
Right, right, thank you. So that annoyance that in New York, seems like if you live here, you're a card-carrying member of the those who are annoyed.
So I identify as an anarchist, and I work for a large multinational corporation.
Great. Great. Thank you. Yeah, I was thinking another one that I didn't mention and didn't go in my response is I identify as an anti-racist, someone who believes in equity and parity. And as a white, privileged male, there's been many situations in my life where doors have been opened for me that I haven't refused. I've walked through those doors.
So I'm a social worker.
Yeah.
And I teach social work. And I have a lot of empathy for strangers and people I don't know well, and my students. And then I find myself really struggling to have empathy for people who are involved personally in my life, who seem to lack empathy for other people. And I try to understand that their life experience has brought them to where they are, but then I struggle with how open I am to letting them into, you know, like I lack empathy for the people who are closest to me when I'm trying to teach empathy and be empathetic.
Right.
To so many other people.
And what do you think is the wisdom element of lacking empathy? So if we were to go a little deeper into that, because we're talking about unresolvable paradoxes, and on the one hand you're mentioning the empathy that you have for certain people, but then for those of you who you're close to not having that empathy, what could you imagine is something in your experience that's leading you to have that edge with those people that you know well and that you love?
I'm not sure, but maybe it's also some kind of lack of confidence about who I am.
Okay.
And if I'm letting, if the people who are closest to me don't share my worldviews, then what does that say about my worldviews, or like the people I'm letting in closest to me?
Okay.
I think there's something about that there.
So you're saying maybe a lack of confidence in your worldview or in this idea that you can have this empathy that they don't necessarily share?
And, or something similar to what you were saying about your white privilege, like being anti-racist,
right,
but then still allowing yourself to benefit from your status.
Right.
And I think it's something along those lines.
Yeah. So this kind of this lack of confidence, or also could be a shame, mm-hmm, that comes up around not living according to this sense of the purity or the ideals or the values that I hold. And then the having those values and knowing and maybe having some confidence in those values, but if I'm not living according to those values and I can't share them with the people I'm closest to, then do I really believe in those things? Thank you. So it's complicated, right? Bringing this back to the path of meditator. So there are different ways that there are different traditions have to work with this. Some of you are familiar, and here in Shambhala, we have many different kind of cultural influences. One of them is Taoism. And in the Tao Te Ching, and this is a lovely, you could say, translation by Ursula K. Le Guin. And I want to read you the number two. So let's transition to how we work with these things, because we've established now that paradox is a constant in our life. It's constantly creeping up. It's creeping up even when we're in our quietest moments on the cushion. And in some ways, the mental spinning that we feel, the claustrophobia sometimes that we feel, is that we're secretly trying to resolve paradoxes that are not so easily resolved. So that actually is, there's an agitation that's happening there. So how do some other traditions work with this? Everybody on earth, knowing that beauty is beautiful, makes ugliness. Everybody knowing that goodness is good, makes wickedness. For being and non-being arise together. Hard and easy complete each other. Long and short shape each other. High and low depend on each other. Note and voice make the music together. Before and after follow each other. That's why the wise soul does without doing, teaches without talking. The things of this world exist. They are. You can't refuse them. To bear and not to own. To act and not lay claim. To do the work and let it go, for just letting it go is what makes it stay. So interesting, right? That idea of the value, of holding this value, something that we hold dear to ourselves, or we hold up as dear. How does it stay when we let it go? How do we follow something without pursuing it? How do we act with integrity and act for justice and for what's right in the world and for what we believe in without pressing forward? Another tradition is the Zen koan tradition. Are you familiar a little bit with this? This is fairly common the Zen practitioners, one of their meditation practices is this contemplation practice of koans, and they receive, the teacher will share with them a riddle that's not really a riddle. And what this story, they're often short stories, they're called cases, and what these cases often are, for example, there's one of the famous ones is a simple one. The teacher says to the student, does a dog have Buddha nature or basic goodness? And the student says, "Mu." And that translates as "no thing." So when we hear a story like that and we can't immediately wrap our mind around it, and or we can, we go right to like, okay, I understand that. And we're many of us are quite good at analysis. So we go to analyze the situation, often very similar to the way we're analyzing our own life, looking for a resolution, looking for an answer to that koan. And we come back to the teacher, if we have a teacher, we come back to the guide and we say, oh, okay, they ask, they say, well, what does it mean? I say, I think it means this. I think it means that Buddha nature or basic goodness is not a thing. So how could you possess it if it's not a thing? That's probably not the right answer. Are any of you familiar, have you heard a little bit about the four dignities of Shambhala? So the four dignities are these four archetypal entities, these four, I like to think of them almost as totems, because often we find in the natural world, in nature, that there's a lot of teaching and wisdom associated with elements of the natural world, whether they be animals, whether they be landscapes, mountains, rivers. So the four dignities of Shambhala are tiger, lion, the Garuda is a magical bird, and the dragon is the fourth one. And as you study, if you take classes here and you study, typically the classes or series of classes will really use as the focus or the main contemplative, the kind of weight of the contemplation, one of those dignities, and there's all sorts of teachings that are associated with each one of them. Tonight we're in the territory of the dragon. Because the dragon is not one for attempting to resolve paradox. Whereas the Garuda flies in vast space and shows us that space has no limits, the dragon plays in space. So the dragon is just as comfortable flashing itself in the middle of a rainstorm, a lightning storm. And in some parts of the world, when the lightning and thunder come, they say that's the dragon's playing. The dragon's just as comfortable playing in the heavens and the ether as it is burying itself in the mud and the muck and staying there for as long as it possibly needs. So you may be walking in a bog. Has anyone ever taken a hike through a bog? So a bog is this amazing ecosystem where, as you can imagine, it's very still, it's very moist. There's a lot of muck, and sometimes you can literally hear the mud like bubbles rising through the mud. And you can imagine that there's a dragon down there. Does anyone know the flower that grows really well in the mud and muck of a bog?
Yes.
The lotus. That's right. And where do we see the lotus? Where do we see it depicted?
Well, it grows in the mud.
Yeah. And it's often the seat for when we see pictures of the Buddha or other meditation masters, it's often the seat that they're sitting on. So we think, well, I would like to have that beautiful seat that the Buddha has. I would like to appear peaceful as the Buddha. I would like to be without conflict and inner turmoil. But actually what we're really doing is we're spending a lot of time trying to wash the muck off. And And we haven't necessarily considered that as we spend time in the muck, there are seeds that are being planted that will be our own realization. They will blossom as lotus flowers. And you could say that's partly possible because the wisdom of the dragon is to stay in that place of the muck until it needs to flash in the sky or until it needs to show up wherever it needs to show up. The dragon is the embodiment of benevolence. And it's also the embodiment of inscrutability. So we never necessarily know what the dragon is doing, but it's always there for the well-being of ourselves and everyone around us. I want to share with you tonight, and my point of view on this, and other teachers may take umbrage. The point is not to stop telling the stories. When we sit down on the cushion and we're following our breath, or we're being with the object of meditation, and we really have the intention to settle, to work with our minds. Many of us think, we really believe that if we can stop thinking, or if we can lower the dial on that chattering mind and come into this sense of kind of peacefulness, that we will have accomplished what we're trying to accomplish. And there's that intention, that aspiration is fine. But there's a very subtle thing that happens because that thinking mind that's spinning the tails, right? Shel Silverstein, that invitation poem I read at the beginning, he talks about sitting by the fire and spinning tails. Those tails that we typically spin are made of lead. They're made of wire. And so without even thinking about how we regard our own mind, our own life, we've already made the assumption that it's strangling us and it's causing a great deal of claustrophobia and pain. And that may be what we feel. But it's not because of our own mind. So if we begin to imagine that actually those stories that we're spinning and those storylines that we're spinning are flax golden, as he says, flax golden, that's so beautiful. So like golden thread, that's what we're spinning. And the way to, the irony, or you could say the paradox, the way to experience that, those thoughts in our life as flax golden tails is to be with the breath, is to allow that story to travel with the dragon into the ether, not to try to hammer it down into the ground like a nail. So when we notice that we're thinking on the cushion, we can have that moment of saying, oh, that's the golden flax that I'm spinning. That's not what I'm doing right now. I'm not putting my focus on those stories. I'll get back to those stories. They're not going anywhere. Right? I'm going to come back and be with my breath. And as we return to the breath, those thoughts and those stories become more and more gold and more flax. Become light and airy and have a certain brilliance about them, which is the nature of our lives. That is our basic mind. It's clear and brilliant. And it has a golden quality to it. So everything that emanates off of that also has that quality. It's just that that's not the way we're relating to it, typically. So I'm going to open this up to see what your thoughts are. And if you're looking for something to respond to, I will also put out the question, the Shel Silverstein's koan is, what happens when the sidewalk ends?
I feel like everything that you were saying with paradox, the paradox to me only seemed to exist if there was judgment of any of the situation that you're in. And without the judgment, that there's no paradox. Is that what you mean?
What do you think?
I I mean, I guess I just didn't really, like, relate to the paradoxes. Paradoxes?
Paradoxes. Paradoxes. That's a good question. What's the plural of paradoxes? So, didn't relate to it because of this, because of the judgment quality that you mentioned?
Yeah, like, just like, I mean, like, for me, I'm a musician, and I'm just like, oh, am I even a musician? Because, but it's more like, not because I don't create anything, but because, like, oh, I'm never going to be as good as this band I love, so why bother? And, like, to me, that's not a paradox. That's just me judging myself. Or, like, being frustrated that you can't move because you're an athlete. Like, if you don't consider yourself an athlete, then, or if you don't, I don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so is it the judgment that makes it a paradox, and otherwise it wouldn't necessarily be a paradox?
Yeah.
Anybody, what do folks think?
I think there are paradoxes that are just inherently paradoxes, regardless of the judgment. One example that comes to mind is caring really deeply about the environment and doing things that I know to be harmful.
Mm.
And whether I judge them or not, the harm is done.
Mm.
I could probably spool out half a dozen similar paradoxes in my life.
Same one. Sure. About myself, but can you do another one?
Oh.
Do another one. Do another one.
I feel like meditation is something that generally fosters my sort of health and development and just helps me manifest as the best human I can. Sometimes there are periods where I won't sleep as much as I need to because I get up to practice. So I'm sort of like physically wearing myself down a little bit. Also, I'm definitely crankier when I'm under-rested. So, you know, I conceivably will go through my day with like maybe a tinge more aggression because I'm like so wedded to this practice that's making me a better person, you know.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for your honesty. Yes.
Thank you very much for the talk. I thought it was really great. So I definitely see the value in kind of releasing the tension, but I also see a lot of value in not releasing it.
Okay.
Like, I think with the environment, like, we should feel like that's bad and right. Try to change, you know? Or, like, if we, like, I think a lot of times for myself, it's like the paradox is that maybe my practice in the world and my values in my heart aren't aligned. And so that tension is there to help me change to align it. And I think that's something I just generally struggle with a little bit sometimes, and I'd love to hear what you think because you're this teacher. Is like, how do you strike that balance between not just give, like when you meditate and you kind of plug into the Buddhist teachings, to not also just become complacent in your own life?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question and reflection on how is it, because I think that's another possible paradox, and it's a little bit related to what Alec was saying. Do I use my practice to avoid something else? So am I using my practice to avoid taking care of myself? Am I using my practice to avoid showing up to act in whatever particular situation that is that I care about, that I believe in? Do I use my practice to say, well, you know, in the end, it's sometimes people will use this idea of emptiness or selflessness to say that it doesn't particularly, our individual choices don't particularly matter because it's all equal in the end and whatever happens is meant to happen, or people will use karma as that. I mean, I like what you said about not necessarily releasing the tension, and I hope that that's what was coming across, and what I was saying was that we're not releasing the tension, we're not trying to release the tension, we're going into the tension. And so the practice of doing the peaceful abiding with that tension is that we may discover reflections, or we may discover a course of action that we couldn't conceive of before, particularly because we were very focused on whatever the value was and whatever we thought should happen or should not happen. And then we become wedded to that idea, and then we turn that into something that we believe is, this is me. And I think that reduces the scope of possibility in my experience. It reduces the opportunity for coming up with answers that we haven't thought of yet. Right, and particularly around the environment, where we're in a situation where we say, well, is it going to be regulation? Is it going to be governmental regulation? Or is it going to be people changing their personal habits that turns this thing around? And if some of us feel like neither of those are going to work, then we feel like, well, we're up Schitt's Creek, because are we going to just destroy ourselves and the planet? So that's, with that level of kind of consciousness, whether or not, you know, because we might share that view, you and I and everybody in this room, but there's other people out there who don't share that view. So we're looking to open up spaces of possibility and spaces where there can be kind of a commingling of ideas, particularly in a more increasingly polarized society. I think it's very interesting that as mindfulness is on the rise, so is this total polarization. And so this idea of, like, is mindfulness, as maybe if you've never practiced, you can see it as an escape from reality. Like, I'm going to go to my place of peace. And I still think that's what my parents think it is. He goes to his peaceful place. And, you know, if he's kinder to his partner and his kids, like, then it's all good. But that there's not the consideration that we may be opening up. The answers may be in our meditation, and by connecting to the potential way forward in our practice, then we find the resilience and the faith and the confidence to move forward. Because a lot of the times, I think it's actually self-doubt and uncertainty that keeps us from acting. So meditation is not only about finding that peace, but about connecting to the part of us that can act from that place when we're under pressure situations, instead of shutting down and feeling like we want to quit and feeling like, screw it.
I have a general question on therapy in Buddhism. Mm. I don't really know how to phrase it because... So I'm not really sure what the question is, but it does feel like that there's a tension there. So, like, Freud never went to Tibet. And as I understand it, you know, therapy can be a great tool for maybe, like, lancing the equivalent of an emotional boil. But at the same time, there's things like... advanced practices here, or like Dzogchen, and it's not like a pressing concern, but it does make me kind of antsy that I don't have, like, even like right now my voice is quivering, although I don't really know why. Mm-hmm. So, like, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's answer A or B, but it's kind of like, I just don't know.
And does that fit into this notion of what we've been talking about tonight, the paradox? Like, is there a potential paradox between psychoanalysis and the Buddhist path? Do those two things at some point come in conflict with each other?
I would say 99% no.
But there's 1%.
Yes.
And that's the quivering quality.
Yes.
What if I'm right?
What?
Or I'm saying, for you, what if you're right?
Oh.
But if they do come in, what if at some point by engaging in looking at your emotions and therapy and going through and analyzing the past and relationships, what if at some point there's a confirmation of ego that is working in contrast to the Buddhist path?
I get to start on the Buddhist path all over again?
Some of the people that I know who are doing the highest practices within Shambhala, particularly the practices that the Sakyong has introduced in recent years. The Sakyong, by the way, is this gentleman over here. He's the teacher, the head teacher of our lineage. And so it's true, as David's saying, there's many different levels of practice within Shambhala. And I have had conversations with people who are supposedly at the highest levels of practice who feel like, okay, I'm ready to start. So I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. And aren't we sort of doing that every time we sit on the cushion? I hope, because you used the word, and it happened quickly, but you used this idea of lancing an emotional boil. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an interesting way to think about it. And it may be that a Western tradition of psychotherapy approaches that. I don't think all of them do, but there may be some out there that do. I think what we're basically saying is that there's a lot of wisdom in those emotions. There's a lot of wisdom in these paradoxes that we're experiencing. So there's a lot of wisdom in you feeling that sense of quavering voice. I had that today. I was at work, and I was in a professional development, and I wasn't going to say anything because I was like, I don't. But then I felt that feeling, right? I felt that feeling of like the heart palpitations, and I experienced that before, and I know that's the moment for me to say, well, I don't know if what I'm going to say is right, but I feel that it is. I don't know where it came from. It's often in response to something else we hear. And can I speak in that moment? Can I speak? Holding the fact that I may not be able to make my point, I might not come across clearly, but I have to speak. And so I think that goes back to your point as well, that in meditation we're developing a sensitivity to that moment where I have to do something now. Even if I'm wrong, even if it doesn't lead to the result that I'm going for, like, I can't. Before in the past I would censor myself, and then in this moment, I'm not going to censor myself anymore. Because I begin to trust that that feeling of palpitation and nervousness is benevolence. That's the energy of the dragon who's saying, you know, this is for the best of everyone involved. Even if it doesn't work or doesn't come out right or... And a lot of us spend so much time distracting ourselves from that intuition and that wisdom that we're not in touch with it, so we don't figure out the moments to sink on when to act from that place. Because we're still developing that sensitivity and we're still developing that, like, okay, now's when I leap. You know, if you come and do a full-day meditation program at the Shambhala Center, there's going to be a moment where you're going to say, after you've done that sitting, that 20-minute sitting period, 6 times in a row, you're going to say, I'm out of here. This is, like, just too much. I'm the most, you know, crazy person here. I can't do this anymore. And then the invitation is going to be to sort of come back to the cushion one more time, come back to that next breath one more time. And how we come back and how we honor these paradoxes, this crazy making, all of these thoughts, how we do that is really, like, with whatever sort of gentleness and sense of honoring that as the golden flax, that is the kind of, that's the stuff that when you do a mindfulness, you know, a mindfulness workshop somewhere else, they're not necessarily going to talk about, I don't think. It's really, those of you who are meditators, you've been doing this a little while, or you're just starting getting going, that moment of when you come back to the object of meditation is so special and precious and to be honored.
I guess I was sitting with so many paradoxes in my life, and I was like, which one do I explore publicly? I guess I wanted to maybe ask you about the tension between my desire for connection and the experience of vulnerability that comes with that, but then also the fear of being hurt that sometimes I fight with to be present with other people. And I feel like sometimes it drives me crazy.
Me too. What do you do when it drives you crazy?
Well, it really depends on where I am in my life. But I would say right now I feel withdrawn. I feel like I guard myself from people right now. My own unique way that people wouldn't really see, but I know I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And it starts to make me feel, I have this experience of, I don't say make me feel, but I have experience of loneliness that is unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do meditation?
Yep.
And how does meditation mix with that?
Well, I get to this point on the cushion where I hear these negative thoughts and experience the loneliness that is underneath all of this. Mm-hmm. And I generally stop sitting when I start feeling that.
Yeah. So that's a common experience for many of us, that when this paradox rears its ugly and painful head, this idea of I want to be close to people, I want to connect with people, and I feel guarded and shut and closed off and don't know how to share. That when we begin to really feel that, the pain of that, again, this is this idea that there's the medicine for that is the gentleness that you would be able to extend to yourself in that moment. So how you can come back to the breath and stick with the object of meditation, stick with your practice, even as those thoughts are arising that are really painful and I don't want to feel them. And it may be that they're really intense and there may be a moment where it's time to get up and take a walk or have a cup of tea or write myself a letter or something like that. But then when the time is right to come back to the cushion and not necessarily feel like the cushion is what's making that happen, those feelings happen. Does that make sense? Because sometimes we get scared away from the cushion and meditating because we feel like, well, that's where I feel the painful stuff. Mm-hmm. The genuine heart of sadness is really, that's the ground of the bodhisattva. That's part of the stuff that the lotus flower grows up from. So relating to that is planting a seed for those flowers. So good luck.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. It's wonderful to practice with you and share this conversation. We have some refreshments outside. Hope to see you around soon. Good luck with your practice. Good night. You're welcome.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you for listening. Hey, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. If you live in the New York City area, you are invited to our weekly Dharma gathering every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, where you can hear these talks live and in person, meet some other meditators, eat some nice refreshments. For more information about other classes and weekend retreats, again, visit our website. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Tell your friends about the podcast. Keep listening. I'm going to go stare at the elevator longingly. Later.